Now, also this week, there's a paper which caught my eye. It's in Nature, and it's by researchers at Uppsala University in Sweden, Erik Axelsson and his colleagues. And they're actually asking the question, well, where did dogs come from and why? Now, we've known for some time that you can trace dogs back in the fossil record about 12,000 years or so, or maybe even to 30,000 years. There's some bones from Siberia that sort of go back that far. But the question is, what made a dog appear in the first place? And dogs are obviously very closely related to wolves, and the current theory is that humans domesticated them from wolves. Why they did that, we don't know, and how it came about, we just don't know. We just know that from about 12,000 years ago, there are dog fossils that are found in association with human remains, showing that there was a close association between the two. So they've actually taken a genetic approach to try and solve this one, and what Erik Axelsson and his colleagues did was they went and got DNA samples from 12 wolves around the world and then 60 dogs, domestic dogs. Now, the reason for using so many dogs is because dogs have been bred into a number of different breeds by humans, and so you've got to counter the effect of this selective breeding. So they've got 60 different dogs representing 14 different breeds. And owing to the power of modern molecular biology, they just genetically sequence the whole lot. And they then used single nucleotide polymorphisms, SNPs, these molecular signposts, to look for areas of the DNA that were consistently different across all the breeds between the dogs and the wolves. And what they found was 122 genes which appeared to be consistently different in the dogs compared with the wolves. And then they started asking, well, what do these genes do? A lot of them map onto the brain and the nervous system. And we know that dogs have smaller brains than wolves. They also have different behavioural traits. And that's probably the crux of it, because there's a study in silver foxes, I think, isn't there, which showed that you can selectively breed certain traits if you go through generation and generation of selective breeding. So a lot of it's down to brain and behaviour. But there was one really interesting thing that came up, which initially you think that it's a mistake, and then you realise it's actually fundamental to the whole process. Genes were coming up which relate to how these animals break down starch, because they found that the amylase gene had been duplicated 40 times in the dogs. Wolves have only one copy. Why would dogs need a 40-fold duplication of their amylase gene? Well, of course, the wolves are eating an obligatory meat-related diet, aren't they? Whereas the dogs, they're saying, the dogs were creeping up on human habitation. And 10,000 years ago is conveniently the time when people started, actually, to have agriculture. So you've got people going into villages, they've got farmers and agriculture, and that means that the kind of things people are throwing away, that these early dogs are probably scavenging on, are going to be very cereal and starch-dominated things. So therefore you're selecting from the wolf population animals that can actually get metabolic reward out of this leftover food from humans. And humans are going to chuck dogs titbits and things, aren't they? And as a result, it has strongly selected in favour of the ability not just to process starch, because they make amylase in pancreatic juice, but they also have got more receptors in their intestine for glucose, which is the breakdown product of amylase. And they're saying, and I quote from the paper, they say, our findings suggest that the development of agriculture catalysed the domestication of dogs. And they say that this week in the journal Nature.
Is there any indication as to the timeline for these things happening? Could it be that the shift in diet then led to a change in behaviour, which then led to the new adaptations, the new selections for the different brain, for example? Or could it be that perhaps having a different brain, perhaps being more likely to spend time around humans, then forced them into a situation with a different diet, which then selected a different population? Is there any way to tell?
It's a really good point, and we don't actually know what the order of these things is. We just know that the dogs are obviously going to be the product of the acquisition of various traits that meant that they were much better at getting on with humans, and they were going to be tolerated by humans and therefore serve some kind of beneficial purpose for the humans, being guard dogs, for example. And they've also got to survive on things that humans are going to chuck away, because people are not going to give a premium thing like meat, which is a premium commodity, to the dog. They're going to give it offcuts, obviously, but they're going to give it other stuff. And the dog that can eat the junk is going to do much better than the dog that can't. So I reckon that's the reason. Mark?
So does that mean then that 10,000, 12,000 years ago, there were wolves who naturally had the chance mutations that gave them a few extra amylase genes? So they had to have that to start with to give them some little advantage in feeding on early agriculturalist scraps. And then that selection pressure increased and increased the number of amylase genes.
Yeah, and I think that that's why they've gone into this and they've said, look, there's copy number variation. So the number of copies of the gene has amplified over time. And the fact that dogs have got that, but the wolves have stuck with one copy, says that, that perhaps one particular substrain of wolf happened to increase the number a bit, and that gave it the ability, like Ben says, to encroach on human settlements and get nutritional benefit from the leftovers that humans turfed out. And at the same time, you've got humans trying to exploit these animals because they're very good at warding off other predators and things like that. And so, you know, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy in the end, I guess. You can actually pick up the references to all of these stories off our website at nakedscientist.com/news if you want to follow up on any of them. But thank you very much to Chemistry World's Laura Howes, to Laurie Winkless from the National Physical Laboratory. She's our Naked Scientist physics correspondent, and to Mark Peplow, journalist from Cambridgeshire. And this is The Naked Scientist with Chris Smith and with Ben Valsler.
Still to come, transparent electronics. This is technology that will project a map of the route onto your retina so we don't even have to take your eyes off the road. We'll talk to the people behind it very shortly.